You know, I'm going to start crying.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to convene the March 31st, 2015 meeting of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. We are convened. Good morning to everyone. We have a very busy agenda today, kind of a cleanup session of several hearings on some remaining bills, as well as a couple of work sessions. So we're going to have to move through the agenda rather rapidly. I'm going to open a public hearing on the following bills: House Bill 2589, House Bill 3428, House Bill 3123, House Bill 3434, House Bill 3429, House Bill 3430, and House Bill 3482. The subject, not surprisingly, is pesticides, and this is a continuation of a previous hearing. We have a list.
Some hiding.
I'd like to call up, please, Mike Gourley, Tom Wolf, and Joe Emmons.
We have a 2 minute clock.
And gentlemen, we're going to run a 2 minute clock here on you, so I apologize for that. But in order to get through our agenda, it's necessary. Welcome.
Chair Witt, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, the executive director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I won't even need 2 minutes. I've already sent in my testimony to OLIST and some two scientific documents on the problems that neonicotinoids, or whatever we pronounce it, have on the environment, particularly on aquatic macroinvertebrates. There's these two studies show that they have a negative impact on these, on the aquatic insects, and could have a major impact on the on stream and river ecosystems. So there's just 4 points I want to make about neonics. First of all, they have a high water solubility. They a broad use. They persist in the environment a long time, and they have a high non-target toxicity. So any, you know, I'm not saying we ban these directly, but in discussions about what to do about this, we need to take into account that they can have a negative impact on aquatic ecosystems, which is my bailiwick. So I ask that you read those two studies. I got it when you have a chance, and I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Tom, just for those who may not know what high solubility is, could you explain that?
Yeah, what it means, it breaks down in water very easily, and it lingers in water for a long time. So once it gets into the water system, it can easily spread into streams. So,
all right, thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. I am Mark Gourley, and I support House Bill 3428, 3429, 3430, 3434. I prescribe, prepare, and administer vegetation management in forest ecosystems on the Oregon Coast Range. For 37 years, I've been treating about 5,000 acres per year using chainsaws, backpack applications, aerial application, and hack and squirt. For the past 10 years, I've been the chairman of the Forest Vegetation Research Cooperative at Oregon State University. I co-hosted the International Forest Vegetation Management Symposium 8 years ago. I have worked with more than 36 master and PhD students at Oregon State University, collaboratively researching vegetation management, habitat, and fish and wildlife interactions. I discovered that by controlling Brachypodium sylvaticum, false brome, with aerial applications of Roundup and Valpar, we enhanced the growth of Kincaid lupin, the primary nectar source of Fender's blue butterfly, an endangered species recently discovered by Dr. recently rediscovered by Dr. Paul Hammond, an entomologist at Oregon State University. Working with watershed councils using OWEB monies and Janet Foltz, formerly with the ODA Pesticide Division, we developed protocols for the safe treatment of habitat, an aquatic herbicide, in fish-bearing streams to control the invasive Japanese knotweed. Our buffers for adjacent crops and aquatic systems are adequate. Before our spray projects, I notify adjacent landowners. Several are rentals, off the power grid, and weekend property users. We are often outside cell ranges for phones. Adjacent to our property are two trailer parks with a migratory workforce. My experience shows that there is not one particular system of advance notice that will work for contacting everyone each time we spray.
Thank you very much. Committee members, anything for this panel? Mike, I a couple of questions here for you. In going down through both the testimony as well as the bills, there were nine issues, I guess, that staff has suggested have been brought up. And one of those is buffers. Can you tell me your thoughts about buffers?
Absolutely. Be glad to. On the federal labels for the herbicides that we use, there are labels. And each label has specific, like atrazine 66 feet from fish-bearing streams. And a side channel that comes in, there's a 66-foot arc. Alistair, the active ingredient sulfametron, it's a 75-foot buffer. So on each label, there's a buffer. Then there's the Forest Practices Act. By aerial application, if we want to get within 100 feet, we have to submit a written plan to state forestry. We cannot get within 60 feet. With ground application, likewise, if we get inside that 100-foot buffer area with ground application herbicides, we have to file a written plan. We can get down to within 10 feet. If the label of the particular herbicide we have, it allows for it. And, you know, this one is one that they actually do spray in the water, the Watershed Council. It just shows you the safety of some of these herbicides. When it comes to, I've read that some of the thoughts are schools, buffers around schools and whatnot. And my wife's a kindergarten teacher, as I stated on the tour that you were so gladly hosted out on our property. But I'm looking at what the LD50, the toxicity of a herbicide like this, versus inside the classroom where my wife teaches. In her purse, she's got Advil and aspirin. A lot of these kids are showing up with these energy drinks, and you have salt and window cleaners and Lysol inside the classroom. If you look at the LD50, the toxicity of some of those, this is quite a bit safer. So I'm trying to understand why we need buffers around schools when we're using herbicides like these versus what's already inside the classroom.
Okay. And I may be asking a question that you're not equipped to answer, and please feel free to tell me so. But if we were to consider buffers, how much is it common for someone to have a house that abuts a private piece of forest land that would be aerial sprayed? First of all, that forest would need to be large enough, presumably, to warrant aerial application. Secondly, that house would need to be close enough within whatever a buffer might be considered. If there were buffers, are the numbers really that great of homes that might actually be impacted?
I look at each scenario separately. Mm-hmm. I don't have a blanket rule for anything. And I look at the relationship we have with that neighbor, if it's a logger, I understand our neighbors because I've been out there for 37 years. I look at the slope, the percent slope behind their house. I look at the wind pattern, the airflow. In some scenarios, the when I go knock on the door and say, "Hey, I'm going to be spraying here in a couple weeks when the weather permits," the more frequent response is, "Would you spray across the property line and do ours too?" Because we got like the Canadian thistle and the bull thistle, they don't want it on their pasture. I go, "Well, the law doesn't allow us to do that unless you go file a notification or whatnot." But what I'll do in a lot of scenarios, I'll go right up to the, you know, what if the label allows, I'll go right up to the property line fence with maybe a ground crew, maybe leave a 100-foot buffer, backpack spray that, and then follow up with aircraft. In some situations, I've done a 100-acre unit all with backpacks. It really depends. There's no blanket rule, and every situation is different, and every person that lives out in the woods is different. So I just kind of size that up, what the risk is, what the weather's doing, and the type of herbicides we're using.
Okay. And I probably was inarticulate in the way I posed my question. Would we expect to find many homes within 100 feet of a private forest land that would be aerial?
Yes,
spray?
This. So I'm within probably 20 minutes of finishing up a 1,870-acre spray project I've been on the last 2 weeks. And I probably had a dozen homes right up to the property line that I've worked with.
So. Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you. Yes, Representative Esquivel, please.
Mr. Chair, I don't know in your county, but I know in our county, I think now we have to have 100 or 200-foot buffer zone between the property line and the home just because of fire. Did they do that in your county?
Yeah, I can't answer that question. I don't know, but that is a very good point. I've been to several workshops in California where fire is a big issue with these homes in around forest land, and the new thinking is to control that vegetation. It was too expensive to manually hand cut that. So a lot of these organizations down there working with rural landowners are controlling that buffer, that we the fire buffer, so to speak, with herbicides, and not letting that woody vegetation. Some of that's fuels like ceanothus and madrone. They emit oils, and it makes for when they get heated up, they get real volatile and they become extremely flashy. So, and they have to worry about flame length and all that good stuff. So they found by the cheapest way and the safest for controlling some of this is with herbicides. And some of that thinking is starting to float up here into Oregon now too. I'm sorry, what was your question?
I said same with the manzanita bush.
Manzanita is a real bad one.
Real tough one.
Yeah.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The instructions that you use when you spray, do they say anything about covering, needing to have gear on or anything like that when you're spraying?
I mean, inside the helicopter?
Helicopter or outside? I mean, yeah. whatever herbicide or pesticide you're spraying.
So on each, I'm sorry.
Are you expected to be wearing certain gear?
Thank you for asking that question. Yes, on each label, there's what they call worker protection, PPE, personal protection equipment, and there's a statement in there that says what you have to wear. And if we're mixing two or three herbicides together, we got to take the most restrictive approach. So when we're mixing or batching, for instance, we got to have on chemical proof gloves, long sleeve shirt, socks and shoes, and on some of the, like atrazine on that label, you have to have a chemical proof apron. A new herbicide that just came out in California, we've done research with it up here, called Pindar GT by Dow. When the backpack applicators are applying that, they have to have chemical proof boots on. And so with Velpar, which the active ingredient is hexazinone, you have to have eyeglasses or safety glasses on, because that can be an eye irritant. But I don't know if I answered your question.
You did, but I have a follow-up. When you're talking with those folks, however few there may be, who live near that area, do you tell them that they need to be wearing those kinds of gear as well when something is being sprayed in their area?
No, and they don't see. This is for the workers. The label's written for the workers using the herbicides. What I'll do, because it's when we're mixing it with water, we maybe put in a half a gallon per acre with 9.5 gallons of water, so that the exposure is quite a bit lower. Some of the stuff we're down to maybe 3 ounces of material and 10 gallons of water. So it's really diluted. And Dan, I don't see, that if they ask me further questions about the material, I provide them material safety data sheets that we provide to all of our workers. We have it in our office for anybody that wants to see it. And I'll get them those material safety data sheets. Plus, I'll get them the label we're using, and they could read through it and make that determination themselves. Then the next thing I do is I give them the phone number of someone like Jeff Jenkins, the toxicologist at Oregon State University. If they have specific questions, I go, I'm not the expert on toxicity. This is the person you call. And so I pretend not to be the expert on what they should and shouldn't do when we're spraying around their house. I give them a whole bunch of resources to contact. Even when Janet Fultz was here with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, I go, here's another person you can call. And so I become a resource for them on other people they can ask. I don't want to come off as the expert on the toxicity of any of these herbicides.
One quick follow-up.
Please feel free.
If a person feels as though they are affected by the herbicide, you're suggesting that they call the toxicologist at OSU.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel as though there is any further responsibility if they feel as though they are damaged by this herbicide, by the spray?
Maybe you could ask that question again. I'm not quite.
Maybe I'm
that.
Not saying it correctly. I'm thinking that if I'm living in an area and I get sprayed, and you may have given me all the documentation that's possible, but I feel as though I've been affected by it. My eyes are burning, let's say,
mm-hmm.
No matter how dilute it might be. My eyes are burning. My family feels hurt by this. The best thing that you have at this point is to suggest that they talk with the folks at OSU in order to find out what they should be doing.
Well, there's actually several things they can do. The way our organization is, if they feel that they have a concern, I'll tell them what we sprayed, the active ingredient, the rates per acre, the wind speed. I try to give people as much information if there's a concern, the wind speed, the wind direction, and if they want to know the nozzle size or how the nozzles are oriented on the boom and the rotor width compared to the boom width, I give them anything they want. I share that. If they feel they have something's gone wrong, they can go to a doctor, and I'd be glad to visit with their doctor and tell the doctor what we sprayed. We had an incident last Thursday. A lady called in and said she was throwing up, wanting to know when we sprayed. And the way we work in our organization is the secretarial staff knows whenever we spray. I call in and say, we're at this unit at this time. We're going to start spraying. When that unit's completed, I tell them they have a whole list of maps. They have all the GPS coordinates to every unit. And when that lady called in, our secretary said they haven't been there within 15 miles of your house. We're just not there, and we're not going to be there, and we weren't there last year because I had last year's maps there. She goes, oh, well, the railroad sprayed right behind my house. Maybe it was the railroad. So, I can't help with the way, the conclusions people jump to. I can't manage that. I can't manage perceptions. All I can do is tell them what I did. We're going to do it right. In my 37 years out there, I've never had that issue come up where we've actually sprayed someone. It's been a documented case. I'll bring in Park to do an investigation. If someone feels there's a trespass, I've gone with the investigators. I've worked really hard with the ODA, their investigative staff. I've been on the phone to the Oregon Health Authority, their staff. We had an incident one time where the helicopter lost its tail rotor, and we did the pilot taking off the landing did a quick dump, and it had Roundup in the batch tank. It hit a beaver pond. It was a weekend. I got a hold of Tom Fisher at the time. He was with the Department of Environmental Quality, the water quality specialist. He goes, this is a non-issue. Cutthroat trout, which is the most sensitive trout in Oregon, could live in your batch truck. The Roundup, the active ingredient glyphosate, they have an aquatic label for it called Rodeo that they can spray right in the water. It has no effect on fish. So, you know, things happen and accidents happen out there. We try to manage that.
One quick, if
you don't. Representative Frederick, feel free to follow your line of questioning.
First of all, we just had a recent incident where a fellow was offered, said that you could drink the glyphosate and he wouldn't have any problem with that. When he was offered the bottle, he said, well, I'm not crazy. That was an interesting sort of comment for me to see. So I'm not impressed with that kind of logic on that. What we're trying to deal with here are some of the bad actors. I understand what you're doing, but you're not necessarily your particular approach is not necessarily as universal as you might think. And I'm curious about what you think we should do when we find that, in fact, spraying has taken place and people have not been notified and people have been hurt. What is your suggestion? They are not being crazy. They are not being hypochondriac about this situation. They have actually been hurt. What do you suggest be done, and how should we handle something like this?
I haven't read all the investigations the ODA has. I do know that I was involved in when Liz Dent was a graduate student at Oregon State University. We did both aerial and ground spraying around our streams and came up with a protocol for water sampling. We found none of the herbicides that we're using in her master's work. And then when she became the water monitoring specialist for Oregon Department of Forestry, we continued that research. Again, we found nothing. And then there was a study done on the McKinsey watershed where none of the forestry herbicides were showing up in the McKinsey watershed. Most of those, the way I recollect, and memory confuses fact here, were urban users, and that's where most of it, the herbicides came from. So I guess philosophically, you got to look at both sides of the property line, in my opinion. We have these urban users that I'd be willing to bet 99% of them don't read the label, are not trained, spraying Crossbow on one side of the property line. I'm certified. I go to probably 3 or 4 conferences a year to get to understand the science, the toxicology, the soil activity, the soil bacteria, the plant community, the wildlife community, the fish community. Many foresters, like myself, are at those meetings. We're trained. And so let's just not look at one side of the property line, what's happening on forestry. Let's look at the other side of the property line also. I don't know if I'm answering your question, how do you manage perception? And I try to do that, but I look at science and facts first. I got to look at data sets. The way I understood if I heard right, Lisa Hansen, I was visiting her about that Triangle Lake. That was in the news forever. My understanding was they didn't find any of those chemicals off the property of the landowner that did the application. None, zero, zip. I haven't read the final report down at Curry County at Gold Beach, so I can't speak to what happened down there. But when we spray, each heliport has a GPS coordinate. And we got aerial photos that we give to the pilot. And I say, okay, you know, I contacted this neighbor. They have a concern maybe about horses. I say, fly around here. Or if they have their horses, they're in the pasture, and they want to bring them in when we spray, I call them and say, okay, bring in your horses. We're going to spray. I might get weathered out, and I might have to call you 10 times before we do spray over the next couple days because we got weather that may not allow us to spray. And when we're done, I say, we're done. Here's what the wind speed was, the wind direction. I really work hard with each one of these neighbors, and I don't think I'm an anomaly of the professional foresters out there doing that. We talk and visit quite a bit. I think there's only four aerial applicators that are licensed to do application in the state of Oregon in forestry. And I'd be willing to bet there's probably less than 60 foresters out there managing that. I know most of those foresters. So I feel pretty good about where we're at.
So, I mean, what I'm trying not to take a leap from is to say that you believe that the damage that people felt was only perception. I don't think that's the case. I think folks really did feel as though they were damaged by some of the spraying that took place.
And I haven't seen the data. And there again, I haven't read it all, but I haven't seen the data sets from ODA to show that in forestry applications. And I try to be pretty good on my reading, and so I don't know.
I'm not. For the families that I've heard from, this is not something that they are imagining. Okay, let's be very clear. This is not the response by OD, by the Department of Agriculture, in immediate response is something that they, in fact, admitted they needed to respond quicker. So they may not have been able to, in fact, find some of that, some of the chemicals in a timely fashion because they didn't go out to test those chemicals in a timely fashion. That's part of what we are also dealing with. So there are, and others have admitted that they missprayed in particular time. So I just have to say I am not. These are not imaginary concerns by people. They are not just coming up with this as a concern. They feel directly affected by this. You may, in fact, be, and a number of, the majority, I'm for sure the vast majority of the folks who are doing this in terms of forestry are following the rules very well. There are others who are not. Deflecting it to an imaginary thing or just saying that the chemicals are coming from household use does not help the situation. In my view, it does not answer the questions and the concerns that people have out there about the use of these chemicals and how they're affecting their property, their lives. I would encourage you, if possible, for you to look at this as a how do we deal with the bad actors, because we do have some, and how do we deal with the fears and the concerns that are not imaginary that people have out in Curry County, in the rest of the county. They don't spray in my county, okay? In my district. My district is Portland. It's going to be household chemicals that are sprayed, and they aren't going to be spraying in the same way. But I do hear from other folks across the state who are concerned about this, and it's not an imaginary, a non-scientific issue. It is a health issue, and they are very concerned about it.
And I appreciate that, and I appreciate everyone's concerns. We try to manage those concerns the best we can, and I fully understand where you're coming from. All I can do is look at data sets and whether or not, you know, how do you – I look at the data. I look at try and manage perceptions the best I can. I'm a little bit concerned that if you have one or two bad apples in a bushel barrel, that you're going to write rules for all that. You know, you look driving up I-5 this morning. I was trying to stay 65, but the common speed was 80-85, and people were texting.
That was me passing you.
Yeah, so, and people are texting. So how do you manage that? There's a lot of risk. Another risk, and I'm not trying to take off on a tangent, but my daughter worked for a food share up in Portland, and I was driving around with her one day. I say, what's up with all these white bicycles hanging on telephone poles everywhere in Portland? She goes, Dad, people are getting smashed all the time by trucks or whatever, and that's what the white bicycle thing is. And so I read up on that, and I think the number three accident way people die, accidental death, is bicycle riders. You go look at pesticide poisoning in Oregon, that's pretty low. I mean, I haven't read where there's been, you know, the data sets and people taking their dogs to veterinarians. I haven't seen it if they've been treated or animals that have been allegedly sprayed. I haven't seen that data set to show that risk, you know, it may have happened. I can't speak to the whole state of Oregon. I don't know how you manage for that to write laws for everything. I don't know.
I understand, and I'm not expecting you to or all of us to write laws for everything, but I am concerned when we do see a pattern or a concern of this kind of these kinds of issues. This is why we bring them up here. Not because someone decided to make them up, because we've heard from families and people in Oregonians saying, this is an issue, we are concerned about it, it is affecting us. It is not affecting us because we're imagining that it's affecting us, but it is in fact affecting us. At whatever numbers, it doesn't have to be 3,000 or 40,000, it can be 1,000. It can be several hundred, but it's something that people are still very concerned about. And that's why we keep bringing it up. So I would encourage you to, if you get a chance, to speak to that. I know that that's not everyone's going to say that that's not not everyone's going to say that that's an important factor, but I do feel as though it is. So thank you.
Thank you.
Next, I'm going to recognize Representative Whitsitt, followed by Vice Chair McLean.
Thank you. I'm not sure if you can answer this, but. When the state licenses applicators, and they mentioned how many that they had, some like 1,200 or something, this is ground application only, and that's why I'm not sure if you can help me with this. Are those people then allowed to have someone else apply? I mean, when I went home down I-5 last weekend, I looked out and I saw ATVs with spray things on the back, and there were Hispanic laborers, farm laborers, administering out in the field. They were spraying for weeds. And I was wondering, are those the individuals that mix the chemicals that they spray, or are the chemicals mixed at the headquarters of the farms? I'm really concerned about the ability of people to read the labels. That's, I think, something really important on ground application. And so I'm just trying to figure out on the applicators, are they tested? I believe the labels are not in Spanish. And so I'm just trying to figure out if we have people out there who are mixing things that don't know what they're doing, or if we're testing to make sure they can read the labels, or if the chemicals are mixed, you know, on the farm, you know, in the barns or whatever you call it, in the grass seed farms. So do you have any idea on that?
All I can do is speak to how we do it. And we have when we have backpack spray crews out there, in fact, yesterday I had a 16-person crew out there, backpack spraying along a county road. And above that, I used a helicopter. And we mix on-site. The person has got a commercial applicator's license from the Oregon Department of Agriculture. All the worker bees, the backpack spray people, were Hispanic. Only two of them spoke English. The guy that had the commercial, Jaime, who had the commercial applicator's license, did all the mixing. All the worker bees have been OSHA trained. So the MSDS and the labels are all there. They have a packet of them. We monitor wind speed and direction, and they were wearing overalls on top of there. They had gloves and chemical-proof gloves and their boots, and those overalls are changed every day. They have fresh overalls to put on. I notice when I drive down I-5 like yourself, they have those Tyvek disposable suits they wear, and they throw them away each day. I don't know if I answered your question, but that's the way we do it. We have someone, if we have a Hispanic crew that speaks English and Spanish, and we go over all the labels. We go over what the buffers are for the creeks with the crew. I have a foreman follow them around that doesn't spray when they're spraying to direct the crew to make sure they're not, you know, spraying in the creek and they're batching right. And then we have a forester on site also, like myself, managing the crews. And in case, again, there's a neighbor concern, even on the ground spraying that we do, I contact all the neighbors. And I tell them, and I try to have just for someone to answer or ask that can be there as a landowner representative. If the neighbor has a concern, we can address that concern immediately. So we show a pretty good, at least in our ownership, a pretty good presence, and we show a pretty high level of supervision. I don't know if I answered your question.
You did. Would you say that is, I would assume, but the prevalent way of doing business in the state?
You know, I can't speak to agriculture because I'm a forester, and I spend my time in the hills and in the brush.
Right. Okay.
And that's where I am, and I can only speak to that. I can't speak to agriculture. I think there may be someone here in the audience from agriculture that he could better field that question than I can.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair McLean.
I'm going to forego my question so we can get on, but thank you so much.
Thank you. Representative Barreto.
A quick one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. 2,4-D, do you spray a lot of 2,4-D?
Yes. Of the 1,870 acres I did by air, probably 1,500 acres had 2,4-D, and then the ground spraying of the 500 acres we did by ground, probably 300. And the form I use has the trade name Hardball. It's not an ester and it's not an amine. It's an acid form, and the reason I like that is it doesn't have a smell. And it doesn't volatilize. And what my primary target is in these first-year clear cuts, and a lot of times more so in the second-year clear cuts, it will be a dog hair of 2,000 to 5,000 stems of either Canadian or Italian thistle per acre. So we treat those when they're about 5 inches in diameter, and we get really good control.
Okay. Follow up real
Please.
Quick. Last week, there was some testimony, some people, when they did an autopsy, they found 2,4-D in their system. Is this something that, in the applied form that you could take in and either breathe in or contact with the skin that it would show up inside the body?
I am not a toxicologist.
Okay.
Or a human physiologist. I cannot answer those questions.
Thank
Sorry.
You.
Mike, going down through the list of issues that have arisen, I wanted to get your feel for some of these. You mentioned that if someone felt that they were poisoned, that you'd be willing to go to the doctor with them.
Well, no, call the doctor. And
okay,
tell them
call the doctor. Straight. Excuse
yeah.
me. For some folks, at least in the hearings that we've had, that information is very important to them, to be able to know what has been sprayed. Mm-hmm. Would there be insurmountable problems if we were just to have a blanket reporting system where people said, I sprayed XYZ chemical on such and such a day, and then that information is there and accessible?
So it kind of is. When we file a notification with state forestry, you know, agriculture, they don't have to do it. In forestry, we do. We got to file a notification. With aerial aircraft, that notification has to be in 2 weeks before we spray, and there's no waiver. With ground application, 2 weeks with ground application, but we can get a waiver from the stewardship forester. We list the herbicides we're going to use. And I was on the committee that developed the forest practices rules for pesticide application 20-some-odd years ago. And I struggle with this, and I struggled with it then, is a lot of times, this spring was a good example, I made my, in order to have lead time to make my prescriptions, I drive up to the clear cut, walk through it, determine what plant community is there, list
all the chemicals I can potentially use, because yesterday on one unit, I had to add chlorpyrrolid was the active ingredient, Transline's the common name for it, because thistle that wasn't there 3 weeks ago all of a sudden was.
Uh-huh.
So I had to add that at the last minute. Well, on my notification with State Forestry, I had listed that. But some of those plant communities will develop that fast in 1 or 2 days, particularly with this hot weather, that weren't there 3 weeks ago. So if we have a record of what was sprayed on every unit by state law, we have to write down the EPA registration number, the rates, and the carrier, as well as who the applicator was, and we write down the weather. We have that.
Uh-huh.
And State Forestry and Oregon Department of Agriculture can ask for those records at any time, and so they are available.
Would the process of reporting, would the burden be diminished appreciably if that were limited, say, to aerial applications only?
Ask me that question again. I got to be a better listener this time.
I want to re-ask the same question and apply it only to aerial applications.
If we did notification to...
Not notification, reporting.
Reporting.
After the fact.
Thank you. After the fact reporting, how would we do that? Are you thinking, how do we get that piece of paper when we sprayed? What would be your proposal, the specifics, that we would scan that and send it to ODA or put it on some website? Or how do we do that?
Possibly a website or something like that.
That we would within 24 hours or down in California?
No, I think within a reasonable amount of time. I don't know what reasonable is. I think 2 weeks is probably reasonable, maybe not.
I like the two-week thing because that's what they do in California. And the foresters I work down there with, that's what they have to do is list within a two-week period what you do. That what you get into is when you have these like a Memorial Day or Labor Day weekend, or how do you get that?
We understand.
I'm just trying to think of the logistics of that. We'd have to work that out. I just hate to see there being maybe we'd have a trial process for such a thing and see how it works. Like, for instance, this new system that State Forestry has on notification online, there's been a lot of problems with that.
Uh-huh.
And so anytime you put things on a computer, it sounds easy, but it ain't. And so I think we ought to have like a 6-month trial period and see if we can accomplish what our goals are. I think we got to have real specific goals and real specific measurables for success if we do a program like that.
Okay. And then one final question here. Another issue that's been brought up is supervision on site. And when you explained who is on site, it had every appearance to me that we would have someone that could be considered a supervisor there. Maybe I'm wrong, but is there someone there that if things went gunny sack, that person has the right to say, we're terminating this aerial application at this point?
Absolutely, both aerial and ground. We do. If there's if something isn't right, we shut her down.
Okay.
We have... so the truck driver, the batch truck driver, the pilot, the two foresters on site, and sometimes three if I have a public road to watch. We're on radio with the same frequency, and we shut her down if something doesn't look right, just immediately.
Okay, very good. Committee members, anything further?
I have one quick question.
Yes, please.
The things that you've described, is that for private land, state land, federal land? Is it for all of them or just some of them?
So right now, my understanding is on U.S. Forest Service and BLM ground, they're only doing a noxious weed program as far as herbicides. I don't believe, at least in Oregon, at least on the west side, I don't think the BLM, Bureau of Land Management, or the U.S. Forest Service are doing any aerial application.
Mm-hmm.
I know the National Park System, I think in Zion National Park, went spraying noxious weeds with a helicopter because they were scattered all through the park. So that there was some spraying in national parks for noxious weeds with a helicopter. On state forestry, we've done joint projects with Mike Todi at the Flomath office over the years, where they had some units right next to ours, and we shared the helicopter. And they're under the same batch of rules that we are,
okay,
and both federal and state. And I think state forestry, at least out of that office, because I'm most familiar with that, does an excellent job at contacting the neighbors also. They're embedded in the community, and so I think they're doing great. Most of the timber companies that I work with, they do business very similar to how we do it. We're not an anomaly, in my opinion.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Is Joe Emmons in the room? No. Okay. Is it Mary or Marie Bowers? And is there anyone else from the public who hasn't testified on any of these bills yet that would like an opportunity to do so? Sir, would you come forward, please?
Got two more.
Yeah. Well, good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Chairman Witt and committee members, for having me. I'm Marie Bowers. I'm a fifth-generation farmer in Linn and Lane counties. We primarily grow grass seed, wheat, and Metafoam. And, Chair, you had spoke on last Thursday about the proof of sustainability, and I would like to say I would think five generations of responsible use of pesticides is a strong case for sustainability. So I'm here today in support of House Bill 3428, 3434, 3429, and 3430, and also in opposition to the House Bills 2589, 3123, and 3483. How I feel is currently that Oregon has the tools that we need to effectively address pesticide concerns that have been brought out in the recent years. However, tools cannot work effectively without the right application, kind of like pesticides. The four bills I support do just that. That gives direction to the Department of Agriculture currently and has, gives the direction to the tools the Department of Agriculture currently has to efficiently address pesticide concerns. These bills will properly fund current programs, establish guidance for pesticide complaints, and ensure aerial applicators are highly competent. The bills I oppose are unnecessary regulation. They would take away an application method or a particular pesticide from farmers or foresters without a viable alternative. It would be punishing the responsible majority of us who follow the label and the laws in Oregon. There are 27 million acres in Oregon of farms and private forest land. The complaints and violations compared to the land being actively managed is minuscule, in my opinion, and does not justify more regulation. So I would just urge you to listen to the science and the professionals that use these tools. There's no need for additional regulation, especially if we establish methods and funding for the current tools we have. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is Mark Dickman. I'm a farmer from the Mount Angel area. We farm slightly less than 2,000 acres from Mount Angel up to around Molalla. I'm the third of what's now a fourth-generation farm, and I'm right now beginning to plant my 41st crop since having come back to the farm from Oregon State University. We farm property that we own, also property that we rent from approximately 20 landlords. Most of those parcels have got a house on them because most of those parcels were a generation or two ago a viable farm. But farms have increased in size and scale, and now those children, widows, grandchildren of farmers have become my landlords. I've seen a lot of changes in 40 years of farming. When I was at Oregon State University, we didn't talk much about what's under the soil surface. And now we talk about all of the creatures from the earthworms on down to tiny little things that you can't see without a magnifying glass. And what do we do to manage those as well as manage the crops that we're growing above? I'm simply going to echo the things that Marie just said to you. I support 3428, 3429, 3430, and 3434 because I think they tighten up or adequately fund programs that are already in place that will help us do a better job of managing our farms and managing the public's interest in their concern with our use of pesticides. I would urge you to not ban the use of neonicotinoids. I don't use them very much, but they're an important tool when it's appropriate. I would also urge you not to ban aerial application. We don't do very much air application on our farm, but occasionally it's a tool that we need.
Mr. Dickman, could you close, please?
I can close, yes. I would echo Representative Comp, Dr. Jensen, and the remarks they made last week, urge you to fund existing programs, to fund extension, to educate farmers, to continue to do the good job that we've been doing. And as to bad actors, throw the book at them.
Thank you very, very much. Questions or comments for Ms. Bowers or Mr. Dickman? I'm not seeing any. Thank you both very, very much.
Thank you for your time.
Appreciate your testimony. With that, I saw two gentlemen who also want to testify. Please come forward. Good morning to both of you. Welcome back to our committee.
So my apologies. I thought we were on the list, so but that's okay.
All right. Thank you.
So, ready?
Please.
So my name is Blake Rowe, and I'm the CEO of the Oregon Wheat Growers League. And, you know, I'm just going to set aside what I had prepared, because I think some of the discussion this morning has gone down a road that I think really needs to be talked about a little bit more. There are some bills here that improve the responsiveness of our system. They provide resources and will give us more credibility with the public and more responsiveness to problems. And those go directly to what do we do about people who violate and don't apply correctly. And that's how you do it. It's no different than enforcement patrols for drunk drivers, adding more resources to patrols, and public education. Those are the kinds of things that we do when people violate the rules. When someone abuses neonics and violates the label and violates how they should be used, you don't ban the chemistries. You toughen up the enforcement, you target the violators, and you don't strip the tool from the folks who use it to great environmental and economic benefit. The same with aerial applications. If someone violates the rules, you don't take away the tool from all the rest. You may target, you may raise the penalties, you may do more enforcement, more training, but you don't strip away the tool. We had someone who violated their responsibility to keep accurate records. To me, that means maybe we have some work to do to make sure records are kept properly, but you don't take the entire record-keeping responsibility off the applicators and shift it to the state. Huge databases have huge costs, and they're very difficult to keep and maintain, continuous cost. So we had someone who failed in their duty. That does not mean that we need to turn the responsibility for data over to a brand new state program. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Morning.
Good morning. Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Scott Dahlman. I'm the policy director for Oregonians for Food and Shelter. We're a grassroots coalition representing farmers, foresters, and other pesticide users. I'm here in favor of a couple of the bills and opposed to a few of the bills. I have passed out some written comments which go in depth a little bit more, and so I'd like to spend my 2 minutes covering some of the questions that I've heard asked today and at the last hearing and see if I can offer some clarification. So for the record, we are opposed to 2589 relating to neonicotinoids. There's extensive comments there about why we are. We are also opposed to 3123 and 3482. On the other hand, we are in favor of 3428, 3429, 3430, and 3434. And I think it's key. The reason that we are in favor of those goes exactly to the question that Representative Frederick asked about what is done if somebody feels like they have been exposed to a product. Those people need to feel responded to. They need to know where to turn. They need to know that somebody is listening to them. They need to be pointed to somebody that can help them immediately. Those are things that the bills that we support would help beef up within the Department of Agriculture, within the Pesticide Analytical Response Center, so that they have standard operating procedures so that when somebody calls in, they are directed to where they need to be directed. To have a 24-hour hotline so that no matter what time of day, people can call in and get the information they need. That's what should be done if somebody has that concern. On the other hand, applicators need to be held accountable. If they make a mistake, if they spray a product where it should not be, they should be held accountable. These bills help do that, along with a Senate bill, which is going to beef up the civil penalties within the Department of Agriculture program that we're supporting in the other chamber right now. There was a question asked about workers versus bystanders and protective equipment. The reason the protective equipment is needed for the workers is because they are exposed to a higher concentration of the chemical as they are the ones who are mixing and actually applying it. It also should be noted that on every single herbicide label, it says directly, it is a violation of the label, which means it is a violation of state and federal law to allow this product to come into contact with people, bystanders, either directly or through drift.
Thank you very, very much. Additional questions or comments? Yes, Vice Chair McLean.
To your last comment, I think it's important, and both of you are supporting the idea that we go after bad actors. You're supporting that we penalize folks who are doing it wrong or being careless. And so what do you do to make sure that the education part that you both talked about a little bit, so we have fewer and fewer and fewer accidents and fewer bad actors?
Yeah. Chair Witt, Representative McLean, we're doing a lot of things as an organization and with our partner organizations to reach out on a variety of these issues. I was before this committee just a couple of weeks ago, talked about what we're doing on neonicotinoids for pollinator education and outreach, and there's some bills before you about actually using some pesticide registration dollars to reach out directly. We've also been working with the Department of Agriculture and a large stakeholder group on the issue of spray drift and educating both our members and others. ODA has recently developed a brochure on spray drift that we're going to be mailing to every one of our 13,000 members in the upcoming month to get that education out there. There's also a video that's been developed on spray drift that we're sharing as well. We're constantly looking for ways to get out there and get that education to all of the different users to make sure we can avoid these things ahead of time and get that information out there so that you're not just coming in with a hammer at the end, but that you're also trying to preempt incidents from happening.
Anything further? Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Appreciate your testimony. And with that, if there is no one else who hasn't testified, I am going to cut off the public testimony at this point. Before I close the hearing, I just want to outline where do we go from here. We're going to have a work group set up to go through the 9 issues that staff have identified through the course of these hearings. Number 1 is buffers. Number 2 is reporting. Number 3 is notification. Number 4 is licensing. Number 5 is penalties. Number 6 is a chart. I need to describe it. I don't know how to just briefly list it. A chart that shows what pesticides are restricted pesticides in the state of Oregon, what ones are banned. Number 7 would be, and the remaining ones, well, the next two are funding related. Additional staffing and funding of PARC.
Investigative complaints.
And number 9, the last and final one is for us to prescribe an investigatory procedure and process when complaints are received about pesticides. Now, we are going to be conducting the work session in the very near term. The first session is going to be Wednesday night, tomorrow night. We're going to do that from 5:30 to 7. We're going to do the same thing Thursday night, and we're going to do the third and final meeting either Monday or Tuesday of next week, to be announced. We're going to take three of these each night. That means a half hour per item. Staff is going to come into the meeting with recommendations based on what we have been told, based on the testimony that we've either received orally or written, and based on the science that they have developed around these issues. The process will then be one of, if the public does not agree with those recommendations to bring forward the kind of evidence, and I stress evidence, that would suggest that there is a better way than what staff has outlined. We fully intend to move forward with a bill to be drafted by LC by the end of next week. So we have to move and move quickly. There's going to be a lot of work. We're going to need the public's cooperation and help, and we fully intend to move forward with a bill. With that, I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2589, 3428, 3123, 3434, 3429, 3430, and House Bill 3482. Thank you all very, very much for the manner in which you conducted yourselves today. And with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bills 2984 and 2985. Mr. Gallagher, can you remind us what these bills are about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 2984 would require Clackamas County to establish the Clackamas Forestry Product Cooperative Project as a pilot program for forestry products grown on non-forest land, and authorizes the county to negotiate and enter into agreements and establish prices for forestry products sold through the cooperative. And House Bill 2985 takes that same concept and uses it on a broader statewide basis available to counties.
Thank you very much. We have with us Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, Westland and Tualatin, and wanted to start by thanking Chair Witt for his leadership as a chief co-sponsor of these bills and the entire committee for being sponsors of these bills. I want to thank you for getting engaged with the conversation. You know, we talk a lot in this building about job creation, and sometimes sort of the left side of the aisle is, well, if we make public investments, that creates jobs, and my side of the aisle is if we cut capital gains, that creates jobs, and these bills do neither. So I just want to, you know, be excited about bills that don't require either of those commitments, and that you truly could be bipartisan. So I am here with Dave Barman, who owns a landscape contract company in Portland, and with Rick Groon, who is our county forester in Clackamas County, and just want to give the history of where these came from and how we got moving down this path. So Dave and I are political odd couple. I'm a Republican. He's a Pacific Green Party guy. And we both really believe very strongly in where these bills could take Oregon and the future of a diversification of our forest products in our state. And so Dave came to me, and we had a really great lunch one day, and he said, you know, hey, I think we can get all this wood from urban areas. I'm like, okay, how does it scale? He's like, I don't know, but, you know, hey, we can get the wood from urban areas, and I'm doing it right now, and it's sort of hodgepodge. And I said, you know what, let me go back and think on this for a little bit. And I don't know anything about wood, but I do know how to do systems thinking. So give me a little bit of time. Let me go talk to some people. You know, I've got some doors, you know, that I can open that maybe you can't. And I went home and told my husband, hey, we're going to be urban foresters. And my husband gives me that look that he always gives when I have some bright idea. And he, you know, said, no way. And I went to and called our county forester, and Rick goes, you're not crazy, Julie. There's actually a way to get here. And so we spent the last year and a half trying to identify a way to capture on what a lot of people are talking about right now. There's a lot of discussion about planting trees in urban areas, in cities, and specifically on the environmental side of carbon sequestration and cooling cities. But you know, these are trees that are going into parking strips and right-of-ways and perimeters of buildings. And those trees are not forests. And eventually they will come out because they are maintenance trees. They were not designed to be necessarily long-term, 100-year type growth, although they could, some of them could be. And right now what's happening in cities across our state and cities across our nation really is those trees go in, and if you have driven by at all this public service building with the tree that kind of rotted out that we didn't take care of and it's all broken over here and there's you know, caution tape around it, that's what happens to urban trees, is that they aren't necessarily well cared for, they get diseased, and their fate in the future is being chipped up for mulch or put it into firewood. And but you know what you're going to hear is that a lot of those trees have value. And so we believe that we have come across a way to not only create that urban canopy and that carbon sequestration goal, but also to monetize those trees in the future for local governments, for private landowners. So, you know, the grass that's all around Intel that they mow and they put pesticides on and they mow it and they, you know, babysit it, and it's grass that's not productive. And yet they're paying a lot of taxes on their property. And so this is a way that they could raise some additional dollars, and however they choose to use those dollars is great. But I'm thinking about the little patch of grass that actually isn't so little that was in front of my kids' elementary school, where the way the school's laid out and designed, that grass gets mowed, it gets fertilized, it gets pesticides, and children can't play on it because it's right next to the driveway of the school district. There's no fence around it, so there's all kinds of rules about what they can do with that. So basically, it's just a really big patch of grass that is worthless. There could be trees there in the future that have a little sign that say, you know, the future of these trees are new playground equipment, because when we sell the trees down the road, those trees go back into the school district's general fund. So I want you to picture, you know, driving down 205 or being stuck on 205, depending on your perspective, where the median is no longer grass and it's instead white oak. And that white oak comes out in the future and becomes wine barrels. I've talked to some of the folks who do, you know, are in our wine industry. Jim Bruneau from Willamette Valley Vineyards. He says he spends $1,000 on a barrel shipping it here from France. He can only use it 5 times and then it's gone. So if we had the ability to look into the future and think about some of the species that have high value, they are hard, you know, particularly some of the hardwoods, and convert them into real products, end products, you know, raw materials, what could that look like for Oregon? And so a lot of states and actually nations are talking about this notion of additional forestry in urban areas. But again, nobody's talking about how to monetize it. Nobody's talking about what happens at the end of the useful life or being on a regular maintenance schedule. We actually think that we've got a way to do that using like GPS and mapping and opting in of a city or a local government or a private landowner to put enroll trees in a co-op. So before we get going with David and Rick, I do want to show you this video. This was done last year. And is there going to be volume, Shelley? Okay.
Scaping can be easy and fun if you start with the right plants. Proven Winners has developed a complete assortment of flowering shrubs.
Darn, we missed the ad.
Been interested in wood, I couldn't resist it.
You give me a piece of wood, I'll turn it into your, you know, anything.
And how do you feel, like, philosophically about trees at the end of their life being turned into lumber instead of firewood?
I feel great about it. I mean, I push it every chance I can. If we can turn it into something that's useful and beautiful, like those benches over there, I'll do what I can to make that happen. We're not removing viable trees, healthy trees. We're removing trees that have defects. I mean, it's an urban environment, so tree removal is a reality. I got over that a long time ago. I mean, if it's a really nice specimen tree, and I see no reason to cut it down, then I do what I can to talk that customer out of cutting it down. If we can use the wood, it takes away some of that negative connotation of removing trees and chopping up and wasting it.
Yeah.
Hi, we're here in Northeast Portland off 33rd and Killingsworth. Yesterday, Mark was driving along and he noticed that this maple tree was being cut down, so he spoke with the arborist company and they said that we were welcome to have the wood. They're going to cut the tree down at the base, and then we're going to pick it up with the excavator and load it in a dump truck, haul it down to our mill site and turn it into valuable lumber instead of it being turned into firewood.
Hey, thanks everybody for coming out. Welcome to our urban lumber demo. Basically, I'm trying to draw attention to the fact that billions of dollars of usable lumber is destroyed every year in the United States. Spalted maple that I'm standing on top of came from somebody's front yard, and this was going to be firewood. I saved it from the firewood pile. Now we're going to turn it into beautiful tables that's worth a lot of money. So I'd like to encourage everybody to understand that when trees come down, that they do have value in the city, and it's sad to cut them up for firewood. I'd also like to make the point that when we plant trees in the future, like this Oregon white oak, that if we prune the lower branches off it, that it's not relegated to the same fate as a lot of other urban trees. So if you have more questions, there's flyers and stuff, but we've got more milling to do, so I'm going to get back to work. Thanks so much for coming out.
Standing here in downtown Portland, we're in historic Pioneer Square today, and when you think about taking this idea, your idea of, well, hey, we should get trees from the urban area, and then creating public policy around that concept, I think we create the inventory that we need. So on the front end, you're creating jobs because we're selling nursery inventory, but on the back end of this project, as those trees are mature and you put them out into market, you know, that's a job creation as well. And we saw with some of the, you know, bowls being carved here, and we see the furniture, you know, it's a win-win all the way.
I can make sure I can turn this off. I think it's off. So, couple things with this. What we envision in this project is that on the front end, instead of the mowing and the fertilizing of unusable spaces, and we're talking right-of-ways and parking strips and spaces that right now currently taxpayers spend millions of dollars to maintain, and we have, when you in aggregate, thousands of acres that could be used for something like this, that on the front end, when we take those maintenance dollars and switch them over into purchasing from our nurseries, we have job creation right at the beginning of this. At the back end, when we do have trees that are ready to come out, that they become real products that are made here, or they become wood exports that go somewhere else and but hopefully stay here. And we're talking about a long time. We're looking at like 25 to 40 years before we have trees that actually can come out. I'll be in a walker, and I hope they make canes out of really nice wood products that are grown here, because I'll be going to ribbon-cutting ceremonies needing my hardwood cane. But this is about long-term thinking, and how do we use our spaces? How do we think about our taxpayer dollars? So this isn't net new taxpayer money, other than the pilot program to get kind of us up and going, so that we have a turnkey product that Clackamas County can deliver to all 35 other counties. But other states, you know, are looking at this as well. I've talked to a legislator in Georgia. She's like, look, if you can crack this nut in Oregon, you know, we'd be interested in doing it here too. That means we have the potential to sell our nursery stock out of state as well. So we're talking about job creation on the front end in our nursery industry. And on the back end, we're talking about the milling and the harvesting of these trees, the turning them into products. But we also see an opportunity for non-co-op trees as they start to hit their useful lifespan, like the tree that fell, you know, across the street, for what we would consider a reclamation market, and sort of like what we do with e-recycling, rather than having cities think about these trees as, okay, they're a nuisance and we have to chop them up and send them out the door,
if companies like David's and others who are out there doing this millwork can start to build, through our county co-op, we can start to build those relationships. Now we can take other trees, and David will tell you about the elm tree on the property he'd like to cut down here on the Capitol grounds and sell. But we can take those trees before they are diseased, before they're falling apart, before they need arborists and maintenance dollars of city governments, and actually turn them into dollars for our roads, dollars for our schools, dollars for city government and county government, dollars for private property owners who want to use their share of a sale as part of an abatement of property taxes or even a net cash value. So the county, in our mind, seems like the logical place to house a county co-op. There could be 36 of them. There could be two or three. So we envision this as having a lot of flexibility. Washington County, for example, doesn't have a forester. They could have a relationship with Clackamas and build some additional scale. But we see it as job creation all the way from one end of the cycle to the other, and a rethinking of how we do wood products in Oregon. And again, utilizing and leveraging the unusable spaces, taxpayer assets that we're currently using in terms of maintenance dollars for budgets, but then also meeting some of those environmental goals in terms of carbon sequestration and cooling cities and all of that, which I'm not the expert on, but certainly has that benefit in this. So I'm going to turn it over to David to talk a little bit, and we can get technical questions about how we see this rolling out. You know, we certainly want, during the pilot, a lot of input. You'll hear from League of Oregon Cities, by the way, that doesn't like the preemption bill. But we'll talk about why we need to have that as well.
So thanks so much for letting me come and testify today. My name is David Barman. I co-own Fiddlehead LLC. It's a landscape construction and consulting business. I also started a second business last year, Epilogue LLC, which is a company that mills urban trees into lumber. In the last year, I milled about 20,000 board feet of slabs that I have air drying in Clackamas County and Charbonneau. It probably has a dollar value when it's dried of probably $200,000 to $300,000. That's something we've been doing part-time. There's a long waiting period before you can sell the wood, so it's not a full-time endeavor for a while until I can get some more capital. Anyway, I just really think this is a really fascinating, interesting issue. Several years ago, I was working on a landscaping project, and there was a cherry tree that was laying there. The house was being flipped by a realtor. And he had had all the trees removed, which is pretty typical, and there was this one log laying there. I said, hey, when are you going to cut that thing up and get it out of here? And he said, I'm not cutting that up for firewood. That's furniture, baby. That's a cherry log. And he found this guy on Craigslist that had just bought a portable bandsaw mill, and he's like, I'm going to mill that into lumber in my driveway. And I just remember standing up and doing a 360 in the neighborhood in northeast Portland, being like, wow, that's fir, that's cedar. These are, you know, I use all of this wood to build stuff. And I just had this kind of like eureka moment, like, this is a cool thing ever. Like, I think I kind of scared the guy and was so excited. But I just kind of went on this journey of just watching people milling wood, and most of them were woodworkers but didn't have a background in botany or plants or how things grow. And that was kind of more of my interest, was like, at the time was a member of the Portland Food Policy Council, was interested in local food issues and how to better utilize land and look at land in urban areas as a resource and not just simply as a maintenance issue or simply for aesthetic purposes. And really, the more that I go along and do this work, and now that I'm, you know, wrangling logs out of people's yards, and I got one 23,000-pound 8-foot diameter log out of somebody's yard in Sherwood. It's a cedar of Lebanon, and you know, it's kind of amazing. The things that I'm coming across is that how much more these bills make sense to me. Because, you know, currently what happens is people call me. Arborists generally know what I'm looking for, but a lot of times they don't even know. They're not quite sure. And I get calls from homeowners, and usually the story goes, they're like, I have a giant tree, so I want you to mill this into something. You go over there and you look at it, and it's really a waste of time. And sometimes it's a branch or it's something that's got like 2 feet of usable material, and the reason is no one cut the lower branches off the tree when the tree was young. It's like really that kind of that simple. And no one had thought about it. And now people are like, oh, that's really cool. I really want to do something. I think this is important. And I found that this is across the board, whether someone's, you know, very conservative Tea Partier, like the place where I rent equipment. You know, we have big debates in the parking lot all the time about policies. And but they're you know, they think it's really awesome and really amazing. I have an older guy that's retired that helps me wrangle logs, and he's very, very conservative. And then I have people that are very, very liberal that are like, I'd really love to have a beautiful piece of furniture in my house, and this makes really good sense to me. But most of the time, there's just not really any usable material, and even if there is, the market is so screwy that I don't really pay for the material. You know, it's a couple hundred dollars that goes to somebody because that's, they're providing one log. They didn't really maintain it. There wasn't any framework for that. So, and I just think, on a side, I went to some industrial chip yards where they chip wood for pulp in Lyons, Oregon, and in Willamina, and they have like furniture grade logs that you can load up a log truck load and get 10 or 15,000 board feet. And that process is so simple. You just go in there, you're like, I want this log, this log, this log. They load it onto a log truck and they drive it to the log site, and the self-loading log truck unloads the logs and you pay the money. And so you think about, like, well, what, why can't we do that in the city? I mean, I feel like if we can grow food in the city, why can't we grow lumber in the city? And in fact, it actually takes a lot less effort to grow lumber than it does to grow food. And then it gets into the bigger issues of, like, I'm passionate about restoring the salmon fishery. So if you're planting trees, that's good for the fish. So you can catch more fish and eat more fish, and there's more economic development that comes out of that as well. So I brought this bowl with today. This came from a 4-foot diameter, 15-foot long elm log that unfortunately was cut up into rounds and wasted. I have a friend that turns bowls, so he brought this. He managed to grab a couple of pieces and turn a bowl, which he gave me a little sample of that. That log is slabs for what I mill, probably had a dollar value, was a finished product of $30,000 to $40,000. And now there's a $200 bowl, and the rest of it's being burned. And I just think that's insane. I think it's just totally insane. It's a travesty. I think no one would support doing that on so many levels, from the money, just the dollar value money, from how beautiful the end product is. And I just think that being able to have a framework to make this scalable, to make this organized, has so many benefits, not just from lumber, but also incentivizing getting people to plant trees. I have a very progressive landscaping business. I've worked on some of the most innovative projects in the United States. I worked on one of the first living building projects, which is the most stringent green building certification program in the world. That's the only job where I planted trees for lumber. I have very progressive clients. I cannot get people to plant trees. But I know that if there's an economic incentive, liberal or conservative, whether you're a farmer in Salem or you're a municipality with land in a downtown area, that if there's an economic component to that, it will motivate you to do the right thing. I've just been reading lots of economic books over the years, and I feel like I finally figured out a way maybe that might actually work.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Witt and members of the committee. I appreciate you letting me come and testify in support of House Bill 2984 and 2985. My name again is Rick Gruen. I manage Clackamas County Parks and Forests, and also serve the county as Ag and Forest Economic Development Program Manager. So I think what I bring to the table is taking Julie's ideas, crazy ideas as they sounded at first, and wrangling her and wrangling David from running around the city, finding trees, is to put some infrastructure framework into this waste to mill concept that, and as you saw from the video, while there are a number of salvaged urban lumber programs across the country, we believe this is the first project that will, of its kind, that actively would manage urban trees for lumber production within a city municipal environment. And why Clackamas County? And I think the reason Julie, Representative Parrish, came to talk to us in the first place is we're one of six counties in the state that has a county forest program. We actively manage 3,000 acres of county-owned timberlands for the unique purpose of providing revenue for our county parks. So we've been able to, over the years, purposely manage our forests, not only providing habitat and recreation opportunity for our people of Clackamas County, but that it does have a specific purpose of revenue generation serving our county parks program. And so I think the reason that we feel we can bring value to this concept is we have a framework in place and knowledge to take it to a scale level that we feel that municipalities, cities, school districts, other entities can adapt this program. We developed the model framework for this program to provide revenue source for municipalities using hardwood lumber products as the principal source of materials. We're using softwoods in our county forests. So the other aspect that I think we add value with some experience on my ag and forest economic development program side, food is an important issue. Dave mentioned that. We've started a couple of years ago, we have an agriculture and forest investment plan in the county, and one of the components of that was to develop what we call the Clackamas Food System One-Stop cooperative model, which is more of an informal cooperative, but we were awarded the Governor's Oregon Solutions to effort to fund that as a pilot program, and we're now into its second year. So the key to this, and with the urban lumber program, is with support of 2984, is to develop the owner's manual for this pilot urban lumber program, working as a public-private nonprofit partnership with the agencies. I've had a lot of good conversation with Oregon Department of Forestry, had the opportunity to talk to the ELCD to make sure that, this is properly set up and managed. Some of the components that 2984 will allow us to do is to design the pilot urban lumber program or forest products cooperative that can be implemented, evaluated, and later adopted across the state by other counties and municipalities. The components that we've conceived for this project is first we have to define what its governance structure is, what type of operation this is, what level of legal entity that the cooperative becomes. Another critical piece to this is establishing the enrollment criteria for how are trees enrolled. And what's kind of critical to this is to identify siting is as important as the species selection. So while we're talking about infill and open spaces and right-of-ways, as Representative Parrish has mentioned, it also has to be approved sites that will exclude riparian corridors, protected habitats, and other areas critical to water quality. We're not looking to unleash a Pandora's box and free-for-all for cutting, which is why I've enjoyed talking with Oregon Department of Forestry and DLCD to make sure they understood that this wasn't setting a precedent of just cutting trees to circumvent other regulations, whether they're state regulations or local municipal regulations. So we envision then that there would be enrollment criteria based on species, based on site, based on development of a management plan so that these trees are properly managed and maintained for this economic development purpose of producing high-value hardwood logs. But while they're alive and enjoyed, they also serve the benefit of canopy cover, shade, cooling, beauty, and enjoyment. But at the same time, we also recognize that there's a cost of maintaining these trees that right now don't provide any economic return back to a municipality, much like our program that does provide the revenue back to county parks. So we also would establish then the monitoring process on how these trees would be monitored. As Representative Paris mentioned, they would all be geotagged. They would all go into a growth modeling so that at any given time, any trees that are enrolled, spatially identified, would also be tracked and monitored for its growth potential so that at the time that it is time for harvest, or in the case of dead or diseased trees, we know where and what, and can then move to the next part of this where we would develop then also the harvesting program so that the co-op would represent the members' trees, whether they're on a per log basis or an aggregate of sort by species and volume. And of course, working with the Oregon Department of Forestry to make sure that we're compliant with Oregon forest practice rules, and that as an economic development and commercial harvesting of trees, we do support that trees enrolled in this program would also be subject to harvest tax in compliance with Oregon Department of Forestry. And finally, as we develop this concept, we want to have a reporting mechanism that we can come back to you all in and be able to testify on an annual basis the progress that we're making with the program. So I think I'll leave it at that for now, members of the committee, and certainly invite any questions at this time. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you all very, very much. Vice Chair Krieger.
Really hard to get me to sign on to these bills.
Because you're like a hippie guy from Goose Bay.
wait, where?
I didn't know that.
You're looking at a generational commitment, because the 40 years that you talk about is kind of the low end of hardwoods. My myrtle trees that are, one of them is 24 feet in circumference. I don't know how old it is. It's been there long before I was born. I'm going to be 75, so... You know, you babysit something that long, it becomes a feature of the community. I think I have to be very, very careful that there's an understanding that there will be a time when they are going to be cut, period.
Right.
We can't even get that done now on federal land, let alone in somebody's park across the street. Mm-hmm. I can imagine 100 years from now, I got these beautiful trees, it's time for them to come down, and the people across the street are going to take you to court and say, don't cut those trees because you've ruined my landscape. Mm. In addition to that, the environmental for-profit industry has got 1,700 proposed species for the Endangered Species Act. They just wait until they pretty well drain society with lawsuits on each one as they work their way up. Anything could be in that park or in that habitat years from now that the lawsuits to do anything would make it totally unprofitable. I mean, these are some things I was thinking about. You know, any frog, mouse, bird, bug. It doesn't have to be a polar bear or an eagle or something more significant as endangered species, where that's kind of where we originally thought things were going. So I think it's a good idea, type of thing you do. I do a little of that myself. And I did mark down whether he had a forest tax or severance tax, and he asked that. So. Mm-hmm.
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, a couple things. One of the pieces that we're interested in is in the 2985, and that's sort of the... You can't cry over these trees or chain yourself to them or hug them. You know, they're in a parking strip. They're not a forest. They are, you know, they're going to come down because they're planted in soil that's really not even designed for long-term sustainability of the tree. And so that's why we're really interested in this piece. Now, you will hear from the League of Oregon Cities that they don't like the preemption. And one of the reasons we are doing that early is that in order for this to work, there has to be the authority that if the trees are enrolled in a county co-op and they're all geotagged, so you would know which ones are co-op trees. And if you had some bad actor, we use that word term a lot around here, but if you had some developer who starts cutting down his trees and says, hey, these are co-op trees, you could actually go code and check them against the registry and say, no, they're not, and you're breaking all kinds of rules. I live in one of the cities with one of the craziest tree ordinances, and I appreciate living in the city of Westland, the city of trees. My city council, all five, four Democrats, one Republican, passed a resolution to be the first city in the co-op, recognizing the economic benefit, recognizing the environmental benefit. Currently in my city, if you want to take a tree out of your yard, you got to like tie a ribbon around it for 30 days, and then your neighbors get a chance to cry over it for 30 days. And if your neighbors don't like it, then you're at City Hall having a fight about your own tree. So we recognize all of that, which is why we have 2985. And while the city might not like the cities might not like the preemption, and it's really one city who sort of spun up some other cities, just for the record. But while they might not like that, you could have ODOT lands in a city jurisdiction. You have school district lands in a city jurisdiction, and we don't want other governmental agencies to be told they couldn't participate because the city itself is not excited about this. So the city doesn't have to participate if they don't want to, but other governmental lands that are within a city boundaries should be afforded the right to use this as an economic development tool. But Representative Krieger, I totally get where you're coming from, and this is a long-term commitment, and that's why I also think we have time to really build the market and do some of that education piece that needs to come out of there. That if we plant that little grove of trees in front of my kid's school, that there is some signage that says, in, you know, the year XYZ, we're going to look at taking these trees out. They're either going to become your playground equipment or we're going to use it to pay for your playground equipment, and actually tie a benefit to that. And just like our timber industry over 30 years came into decline for a lot of policy, I think the reverse can happen, that over a long period of time, we can actually do the education piece that has to happen in order to make this work. And at the end of the day, if this doesn't work, all we're stuck with is a bunch of trees. And that's not necessarily a bad outcome either.
Well, just real quick, you know, I think the first trees we planted on a tree farm in 1980,
mm-hmm.
about 100,000 of them from then forward, and they're 20 to 28 inch dug fir, limbed up. I don't know if I, even though it's huge value, I'm not to the point where I want to go cut them.
Follow up to that, Chair Witt, Representative Krieger. The beauty about this program is we're going to operate this sort of like a dairy co-op. These are your cows and these are my cows, and we've agreed as co-op members in a dairy co-op that we're going to maintain our cows a certain way, and they're not going to get E. coli or whatever, and they're going to have a quality standard that's agreed upon. So we're talking about a limited amount of species, and then we're talking about, you know, who owns those trees up until the very end. So what we envision on the notification side is, you know, you've got your private landowner and you planted 20 black walnuts for this program, and the forester has identified that your trees are ready to be part of potentially a sale, we're going to give you those geocodes and say, hey, are you ready to have any of these trees come out? And you could choose to have 5 of those trees, 10 of those trees, none of those trees. It's really up to the landowner. So you could be a city who gets into a situation with a neighbor and you planted a tree in a park, and you know, the neighbors come cry over it, and the city could make the decision to unenroll that tree. So the trees don't belong to the co-op until such a time that you've opted in and you're ready to have them be part of an aggregated sale.
David.
I just also wanted to add, I think those are really, really good questions. I've definitely had a myriad of conversations with folks from people like, that's really interesting. I really appreciate what you're doing. Like, I've been told I'm an evil, terrible person. Which is interesting.
We get called that every day.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's a little. Yeah, this is an interesting place to be in. So, but I think that that's really. I think those are really important questions, and that's why I feel like, you know, in an urban area, it's a little. It's a different kind of forestry, and I don't have any specific like hard and fast stuff that, you know, that we can point to. Yeah, that's what, you know, that's asking for funding to figure, tease out those things. But I feel like most people, if you're growing a mixed age, mixed species forest, and you're doing selective thinning of trees, if you come in there and you start just cutting, you know, gashing, taking out all the trees, you know, like I look in Portland, I live on the east side of Portland now, and there's a lot of development, and there's just like, boom, there's like all of a sudden it's just, there's a lot scraped and everything's gone. And then people don't like that. But if people have some education and you're taking out something that, you know, it's like different sizes of properties have different kinds of scales. And so understanding that and being responsible, I would say 80 to 90% of people are reasonable enough to understand that, yes, I have furniture and I live in a house. And while, yeah, I might be upset about a tree or two coming out, that I understand that it's going to build things that I'm going to use or people in the community are going to use. And I think that's really the important piece to that. But if you go in there and you're just taking everything out and there's no explanation, yes, people will go nuts about that. Anyway.
And Representative Krueger, one comment to add to yours, and I agree, and great questions, is we also are looking at provisions to consider how do we enroll maturing trees so that we don't have this lag between, you know, the initial plantings, which certainly is the primary goal, but the secondary opportunity would be to enroll trees that are maturing, that we can create this opportunity earlier on and establish kind of the history and demonstration of this program without waiting, you know, the 20, 30, 40 years while these are all cycling in. So I think that provision would help the component rather than have that generational gap where, you know, 30, 40 years from now, they said, what were those crazy people thinking back in 2015? So that would provide some continuity to the today to the into the future.
I want to add one thing to that as well, that when you're talking about enrolling existing trees, that's not something where like suddenly like, okay, we're going to start harvesting trees. I think that it's really important to get, you know, increased tree canopy. But if like, so for instance, this tree, right, this was, it died. It was a dead tree in a parking strip. And now it's been burned. And that's tens of thousands of dollars worth of lost revenue and a waste of a material, but people could register that tree, and under local ordinances, you would have to follow the rules. But if a tree does need to be removed, why not have a way that you could put that wood to good use and help it find a home instead of a handful of companies racing around randomly looking at logs and trying to figure out if this Caucasian wingnut tree. It's an inside joke for Representative Federer.
Yeah,
he can explain it to you.
There is a Caucasian wingnut tree.
There is, yes.
Give me a limelight. Yeah.
Anyway, the short of that is that I think it is important to find a home for a lot of mature trees that otherwise are going to go to waste, and they do have economic value. And I think that there's a way that most people, not everybody, but I think enough people are supportive of that it's a reasonable thing to do.
The last three things, Chair Witt, and committee, I want to leave you with is, you know, apparently before I got here, there was some goal put together that said cities by some year in the near future would be really working on reducing their carbon emissions. The interesting thing about this is that because we know the age of the tree, we know the location of the tree, they're all on a map somewhere that people can go see. And we fully anticipate that, you know, people go look and see what is our urban forest look like, that you go to Clackamas's website and see, you know, here's dots on a map that actually show you what this looks like. But because we know the age and the species and the variety, you know, Rick believes that we can quantify the carbon sequestration that's happening. And so from the perspective of cities and jurisdictions that are trying to meet these carbon reduction goals, you could zoom down into a special district, you could zoom into a city, you could zoom at the county level and say, even at the state level, and say, this is the sequestration that's happening. And the other piece, the second of three, is that in highly urbanized areas, when you're talking about Representative Frederick's district and it rains in the city of Portland and you have all these urban trees and they're beautiful while they're there, these trees are going to be limbed up to grow up and be saw logs. So that means that there's less leaf drop into your gutters and sewer systems that have to be managed. Less maintenance of, you know, tree branches that are snapping on cars. Or my neighbor's tree actually fell onto my greenhouse after I just put it in the first year that I put it in. So less damage to taxpayers. And, you know, also in terms of power lines and things like that, we're talking about a lot less opportunity for damage that comes with the urban trees. Even though that's our goal, that it's really difficult to get them in and managed and properly maintained for. So we actually see a potential future for reduction in maintenance costs and arborist costs of these trees long term, because we're really caring for them properly to grow up and be saw logs. Lastly, I'll say that this does have a budget request. The one bill doesn't have a fiscal, but this one does. There's also going to be an amendment from the forest folks. They're neutral on the bill right now. I'm actually meeting Governor Brown tomorrow to talk about these bills. But they've got some legalese things that our LC folks missed, so that brings us in compliance with federal and some additional state things. So there'll be amendments drafted for that. We do know that there's a fiscal ask. While we hope to get the full 750, which gives us enough to build all of the, I mean, we want to bring a turnkey, you know, product to all 35 other counties and say, here you go, go turn on the lights. We're still here for support in Clackamas, or you can join Clackamas. But we want a turnkey product that all 35 other counties get to actually use and start using in 2017. You'll notice I will just invoke my senator, who rarely puts his name on fiscal-related bills. He's all about not spending the money. But this is a priority for Clackamas County. Senator Devlin's one of our sponsors on here and has agreed to help me try to find the money in the budget to make this work. And the Oregon State Chambers of Commerce has endorsed this as one of their priority bills for this session. Jeff Stone from the Nurseries Association, I've talked to him extensively. Obviously, for his members, this is a huge opportunity to see increased nursery purchasing in our both in-state and potentially in out-of-state in the future. We have talked and worked extensively with a lot of the conservation groups. Friends of Trees came out and did the first planting in Clackamas County with us. They were at the milling demonstration. You saw their little mascot guy. They're still trying to wrap their heads around how do you change your business model to move forward with something like this, because it's sort of outside of their normal realm of conservation. But you also notice that there's not any of our conservation friends who are here in opposition today, because I think they're starting to get it. I've talked to the Nature Conservancy and the trout people and like everybody who's got one of these groups. We try to do as much reaching out to them as possible. And the conversation I have in my office with those folks is everyone's sort of like, huh, okay, well, that makes some sense. Like, we could wrap our heads around that. So, and we envision an advisory council as part of this effort. So as we are doing the pilot, it's not just, you know, Clackamas County operating in a vacuum. We really want to have the League of Cities involved in that conversation. We want to have conservation groups at the table, particularly a group like Friends of Trees, who is actively out doing the planting work and going, okay, how does this potentially fit into our model that we're going to plant the trees and maybe 40 years, take them down and plant some new ones in the same space. So so we envision a whole sort of host of folks to really deal with how do we get this to the legislature, make any other technical or legal fixes that have to happen in 2017, but actually have a turnkey product that is ready to go for the entire state of Oregon. And I sort of feel like, you know, generationally, this is like a bottle bill moment for us. Like, we are trying to, we don't do a lot of long-term thinking in this building. We sort of try to get through election cycles and campaign cycles. And this is about being thoughtful for what does wood products look like 40 years in the future for Oregon. And so it is one of those moments where we get to really think further ahead of ourselves and lay a framework for jobs for my kids in the future, potentially, or your grandkids in the future, potentially. So we know there's some other people who want to testify, and we're around also for questions if you've got more. But I know there's a few other people, and we're going to butt up against caucus meetings and floor sessions. So
before I recognize Representative Esquivel, Vice Chair Krieger, you put on the record that you hate to cut 28-inch trees. Would you care to tell us how long the mourning period is? Or?
I don't know. I haven't cut any yet.
Okay.
When you plant them, they're almost like cutting the legs off your kids.
Very true.
David will come cut them for you.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, in the city of Medford, we have parking strips that have trees in them, but we're very specific on what kind of a tree you can put in there due to the fact that a lot of trees grow up, uproot the sidewalks, go into people's driveways, undermines their driveways, undermines their sewer systems and their water systems, actually. So how do you go about that?
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, that's actually a really good reason why we do this. Because at some point, rather than let those trees just grow unwieldy, which is what they do now, and they tear up sidewalks and they tear up roads, if we capture them before they start to do that and turn them into, you know, put them out and part of that management, that's one of the reasons why we're doing that. Because everyone's interested in this, like, let's plant urban trees, but no one's talking about the damage that they cause. No one's talking about, you know, the leaf drop and power lines and tearing up sidewalks. So if we can plant those trees and then get them out before they cause that damage and then put new ones in, we want to be on a cycle of regular management with this, which is a different way to think about sort of that beautification of your city, but also making sure that long-term there's not that damage that you're describing.
Well, but usually by the time the trees establish, the damage is almost done, because by the time you realize it, it's done. Mm-hmm. So The other thing I'd like to say is that, and many, a couple of you have been to my house and saw the tree in my front yard, silver maple. We had to cut it down the other day because it was hollow on the inside, mm-hmm. and we lost a 91-year-old tree. So couldn't utilize much of the product because the inside was three-quarters hollow. So.
Okay.
All right. Thank you all very, very much. I'd like to call up next, please, Tracy Rudden and Lee Chimerson. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Please decide who goes first.
Oh, thank you. Good morning, Chair White, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tracy Rutten, here today with the League of Oregon Cities. I get to be the one who drew the short straw to testify with concerns. I did indicate opposition on the sign-up sheet, but really would indicate that we have concerns that we would like to work through on this bill, especially considering that the chief, one of the chief sponsors and all of you have signed on in support of the bill, so that really is a short straw position to be in. I did talk with Representative Parrish last week after hearing from a number of cities who expressed their concerns over the bill and cited some concerns specifically over the preemption that is included in one of the bills that would be implemented should the program be passed. We certainly can see the merit for this program, and again, I would love to see an opportunity for us to have a path forward and see this program be implemented, especially as a pilot version in the initial stage. But we would strongly encourage some further consideration be given on how these programs would function within city boundaries. Certainly, these programs would impact cities in many ways. There may be some cities who obviously would wish to participate in this program, I think, who could actually see the vision of this being a potential opportunity and funding opportunity for their city. So I do see that there be a path and an avenue forward. As drafted, however, these bills don't allow for cities to actively participate in the program at the onset of the adoption of the pilot program. And again, these programs would have very direct and real impacts, I think, to communities. Just in terms of livability overall, trees are a landscape of communities. They're important to communities. They're an issue that we deal with frequently. Citizens are very concerned about trees in their cities, and we hear about them on a regular basis. So for many of our cities, they are participants in the Tree City USA program. Actually, 49% of Oregon residents are in a city that is a Tree City USA participant. In order to be a participant in that program, you've got to meet several requirements, and that includes adopting some specific ordinance about around tree maintenance and care, so it's something that we do talk about frequently, as well as designating either a tree board or a department that oversees those tree care and functions, and then also dedicating some specific funding. It's actually, I think, a $2 per capita requirement for those programs to be established and for you to be a participant in Tree City USA. Local tree ordinances are typically very detailed with specifications for maintenance, considerations to preserve proper street lighting, reduce interference with above and below ground utilities, and I would agree with Representative Esquel indicated. Those are conversations we have frequently, is how trees that we plant in certain right-of-ways will impact utilities, as well as the lighting in a parking lot, for instance. Part of Tree City USA also has cities indicating preference for the types of trees that should be planted in their communities to make sure that those things are given consideration to. As cities, we also have specific zoning requirements that come into play here and ordinances that prohibit certain activities in certain zones. Passage of this bill would I think, cause direct conflict with some of those zoning regulations and is something that we'd like to have some conversation around. This would certainly allow for some commercial activities to occur within residential zones. For neighbors who might be concerned over harvest practices when they do occur, we just want to make sure that we are very careful as we move forward with this program. It was mentioned earlier that, yes, you can grow food in a community. Why can't you have forest practices in a community? But growing food in a community can be done, but within reason and within those local zoning ordinances as well. You know, and quite frankly, we just don't know how many trees might be planted in this. We don't know how many private residential landowners might want to participate in the program. We don't know what types of trees they would be allowed to plant or what kind of specifications for where they can be planted, how close to utilities, things like that. But we do know that we are the ones that are most likely to receive that phone call from the concerned citizen when there are issues with potentially this program particularly. And I think that's one of the challenges that the bill is presented and why I think a pilot program is a good opportunity and one we can learn from. We would like to have some voice and involvement on the onset of the program just to make sure that we could take a look at how many participants we might want to see, whether there are certain considerations for a given community that needs to meet some individual needs. And I would agree, too, with what Representative Prieger said. You know, when that old oak tree comes down in a neighborhood, you can't stop the person from crying. You can't stop that mourning period. It's going to happen. It happens frequently. And even if the tree is diseased, it still happens. People do really care about the trees in their communities. So I don't see that a preemption in this bill is necessary in order to have a successful program. And again, we do oppose the preemption language that is exists in House Bill 2985. I think we should be able to have a voice in how the program works in our communities at the onset of the implementation of the program. I really do see that cities could be a very great partner in this program and help to make it more successful. I think cities could provide some opportunities for education and let people know in the community about the opportunities around the program. And where it comes to those trees that are either diseased or problematic and do need to come out, I think there's some other opportunities there that might exist for trying to educate and inform people on options that they might have when those trees do come out. And we would love to be at the table to have that conversation. I probably don't have complete authority to offer up all of my Clackamas County cities to participate in a conversation, but some of those are the ones that have indicated some strong concerns, and I know that they would be happy to sit down and talk through those and see if we can't find a way that we can work through those issues and make this a successful program going forward. I thank you and happy to take any questions.
Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think that what we have here is a potential for a great program, and I think we need to pursue it. I understand what the cities are saying, but then again, sometimes you get involved with city red tape, too, and that's a real, real hassle. I'll be candid with you. I can go into detail on that, but we'd be here forever. But I came from a city council, so I do understand that. I do understand the fact that the city would like to control that and be partner of it. But I think we have an opportunity here, and if we pursue it and with an open mind on both sides, I think we can come to a conclusion.
Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Witt. You've brought up some interesting points, and I'm curious to know through your conversations with your cities, this has basically been an urban idea for an urban pilot, and I think it's a fabulous idea. I think it was very exciting when Representative Parrish first brought the idea, and I think it's just grown and gained momentum. But I'd like to know if you're hearing from your smaller rural communities about this and how it may benefit them, first of all, and then impact them if there is a downside. And I'm particularly interested in you bringing up the Tree City USA, which in my district is something that they are participants in. So how much conversation have there been with people outside the metro area on this?
Chair Witt and Representative McEwen, quite frankly, the most feedback we've received is not from rural communities. It has been from more urban communities and higher populations, not large cities, but certainly we have not heard as much from our rural communities. Again, frequently they don't have the staff that looks at all of these issues as often. We will be communicating with them and have communicated with them, but we tend to hear from those who have more staff, and I think those with the higher populations are the ones that have some of the more significant concerns with trees in their areas.
Sometimes our rural communities know how to grow trees too.
Certainly. Yes.
Thank you.
Good.
Sir, good morning.
Welcome. Good morning, Chairman Witt and fellow members of the committee. My name is Lee Jimerson. I work for the Collins Companies. We're top 25 or 30 privately held companies here in Oregon. We're a 160-year-old privately held company, currently headquartered in Wilsonville. We recently moved from Portland. We're the first privately held company in the United States to get our timberlands FSC certified. That's the Forest Stewardship Council. We voluntarily did that starting in 1993. So our lands down in Lakeview, Oregon, as well as Northern California and Pennsylvania are all under the FSC standard. And so a lot of our market is the green building market. That's who we go after with our various products is a green building community, and still a small but growing market. So that's my day job. I'm also currently the volunteer president of the Western Hardwood Association, and its mission is to be a authoritative resource for a sustainable, profitable, and growing Western hardwood industry. Traditionally, that's mostly been 90% alder coming out of clear cuts where they weren't properly managed. Alder is a pioneer species. It'll come back when a tree blows down, everything else being equal. But that also includes species. The second one would be West Coast maple, Pacific albus, which is what I do for my day job. It's a plantation in around Hermiston and Pendleton, a tree farm, and which is FSC certified. And one thing about Forest Stewardship Council, which is endorsed by World Wildlife Fund, Greenpeace, NRDC, they do have a part of FSC that says plantations are acceptable if they've been grandfathered in, that they didn't come from a deforested area, because FSC understands humans are going to use a certain amount of fiber to get about our daily work, whether it's the restroom, producing bills, printing paperwork, building houses, making furniture. And so if we can intensively manage a very small part of our landscape, that will reduce the pressures on more sensitive, more biodiverse areas. Think of the Green Springs down around Ashland or the Mount Hood National Forest. So reducing pressures on those sensitive areas. And that's why I think of the urban area as being a less biodiverse, intensively managed area, where that resource is, for the most part, not going to its highest and best value currently. Most of it ends up as firewood. A lot of it is suitable for firewood, but there's that, I don't know if it's 10, 20, 50% that can go into a beautiful table, a beautiful floor. And that resource is really being squandered at this point. I mean, there are some successful examples. David, who spoke here, he's got a fledgling business and he's doing some. There's a couple other guys, but the system doesn't really seem to work. It's not scalable under its current setup. We're a privately held company. We have a sawmill in Lakeview, Oregon. We don't use urban wood. We're not really set up. I mean, we wouldn't probably be involved in an urban wood type of thing. But you know, it's the system just doesn't work. So I think this bill really can help bring that about to make that so that it does work. One other thing I just wanted to mention, I'm the immediate past president of Salmon Safe. I don't know if any of you folks have heard of Salmon Safe, but it's, you think of FSC for forests, Salmon Safe is really a voluntary land-based management system to try and reduce your environmental footprint on a watershed. Nike's campus is certified, Portland Parks are certified, a lot of companies have stepped forward, and that aquatic overlay, Oregon Tilth has taken the Salmon Safe aquatic standards and overlaid that. So it's you know, it really come from a, you know, in my 20s I was buying timber products over in Southeast Asia. I saw the good, the bad, and the ugly. So I've really focused my life on how to be a positive influence in the forest products industry, and there is a way we can do it much more sustainable than we do in the past. I just see this urban lumber program as what I call low-hanging fruit. I mean, there's wood out there to be had that we're letting go to a much lower use. So, you know, I don't see why we wouldn't want to try and capture this resource. You know, the fiber constraints, a lot of our logs out of Oregon are being exported to China now. There's restrictions on federal forest. There's restrictions on state forest. The industry can and needs more fiber. It's a continual battle. And this looks like, I say, the low-hanging fruit to give the industry more fiber so that consumers can have the furniture and the wood products that they need. So as David said, this bill will give us the legal framework to make it a scalable industry. It's not quite there yet. Just walking in today, there's this beautiful elm tree on the left. You guys all with the big burl about 10 feet up, you see that? I think that's on state parks land. I mean, that tree in the next 30 years is probably going to blow over, or a forester's going to say this is a health hazard. I mean, it's beautiful, but I would say it's in its sterile stage. It's in its later years. If that blew down today, what would happen to that tree? Would it go to firewood, or is there a legal mechanism for that tree to have, you know, is David going to be able to swoop in and say, I'll give you $1,000 for that tree? Could that happen? So hopefully this bill can make some of that happen. So the bill promises economic growth, which I think we all feel is important. It helps us with our landscape management. So we talk about federal forest, state forest, private lands, plantations. This urban forestry, it really fits into looking at Oregon as a state and how we can best utilize our resources on a true landscape level, you know, where we have areas that are set asides and we have areas that are more intensively managed. And looking at it really holistic.
Mr. Jemerson, I'm going to have to ask you to close,
okay.
If you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, very good.
Thank you very, very much. We have to be out of this room. We're 5 minutes late. Mr. Jemerson, the fact that you would show up in a company of your size to testify on this bill speaks very, very well of the company that you're representing. Thank you so much for your testimony. Tracy, I'm going to give you until Friday. For any amendments, Rep. Parrish needs to get that bill down to LC. We're going to be eagerly awaiting this bill. So Friday's the deadline. If it's not in by Friday, we're moving the bill. Thank you all very, very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bills 2984 and 2985. I'm going to carry over work sessions on House Bills 2474, 2687, 2184, and 2537. On 2537, anybody who's got amendments, get them into Vice Chair Krieger. He's the fix-it man. And lastly, I'm going to carry over a public hearing on House Bill 2183. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.
Brad, thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry that I went into a... Brad, thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry that I...